Right, welcome back. So tonight I'd like to start with a little story, a true story that came from 1930. Actually, 1930, 1830, set in the British Isles. And a member of Parliament named William Huskin was attending the opening of a railway. So the first railway in the area. And during it, he stepped across the track when the train was coming and was run over. So he was there as an officiant to, appreciate that new event, and had no idea of how fast that train was going. No way how to gauge the speed and the distance. It was such a foreign thing to him in his world of horse-drawn carriages and carts. And what does this have to do with the Dharma? What does this have to do with dependent origination and with some of the pressing issues of our time? There's a famous sutta called The World, when the Buddha says, "What is the origination of the world? Dependent upon I and forms, there arises I consciousness. And the meeting of the three of these is contact." Is contact. So we have an eye that works. We have something to see, and we have the consciousness. When those all come together, there's this point of contact. From contact, then comes feeling or feeling tone. From feeling comes craving, from craving, clinging, from clinging, becoming, from becoming birth. And then from birth, there's old age, aging, deaths, sorrow, pain, distress, despair. This is the origination of the world, all flowing from that one point of contact. So when William Huskinson created his world with contact, saw the train, he says, "Okay, there's this object. I don't know what it is, but it's that far away." And he judged he had plenty of time. He created his world, his reality, through that point of contact, based on his past experience. Takes this long for a wagon to get to me, drawn by a horse. He had no idea how fast a locomotive could move. And so he created his world, and then the real world ran him over. So this creation of the world is what I want to focus on tonight, how from this one point of contact, this seemingly benign point of hearing or sensing or thinking something, how we quickly create this whole world. And from that world of that we've created, we act. We go into a sense of agency, of action, of how we live our lives based on something that we've essentially imagined, something that we're essentially interpreted. And as Dharma practitioners, we see that this holds the root of our suffering, not only for our own hearts, in our own lives, in our own minds, but also the suffering of the world. This added on imaginary creation of the world, all interpreted, all distorted from this point of contact. And this is really the teaching of dependent origination. In another sutta, the Buddha describes this in this phantom long body that's perishable, that will perish, with its perception and its imaginings are contain the world, the arising of the world, and the cessation of the world, and the way leading to the cessation of the world. This is such a simple statement, but yet also profound, that just within this set of this body that we each hold, we have these senses of touch, of hearing, of sight, etc. And from that basic point, we go into creating the sense of the world, this of how the world actually is. Our reality. This is describing dependent origination. It's describing the Four Noble Truths. This world we create through the contact of the senses, including thought, including what our mind thinks. But it's a world of our imaginings and of our perceptions. And as we've been exploring in the earlier links in dependent origination, we see how that is surely shaped by our past history, our past actions, our past conditioning. And we act based on that world that we've created. all flowing from this moment of contact. And it's so important to reflect that this is not an objective contact. It's not a universal contact, that it's subjective. It's shaped by our history, by our memories. So this poor man back in 1830, you know, his world contained certain things and certain assumptions of roads, of pathways, of horses and carriages and ox-drawn carriages. And it worked pretty well. He's able to navigate that world. Until this invention made all that assumption, all that world out of date. The railroad tracks, the steam-driven locomotive. So we act based on the world that we've created. So as I talked about a couple of weeks ago, the idea of implicit bias or racial bias is an example of this world that we create when we define something as other, someone else as other, often unconsciously, that we don't even realize that is this world that we've stepped into, that we've inhabited, and we're operating from the rules of that world. Acting from that world, not from reality. The practice is about learning to connect with reality, to live from that reality. Really, the genius of dependent origination, as conceived, as taught by the Buddha, describes how this world is pre-programmed, how all these previous links that we've explored of sankharas, of name and form, are activated by that point of contact. And then also how the next stages that we go on to in this rest of this year of feeling tone, of clinging, of craving, the becoming, the birth, the sense of self, and how this also is the world that we've created. And this is not something it's abstract. It's actually something that's happening constantly. We're constantly inhabiting this world that we've created. And there's a self that has to be there with it, who's experiencing that, that's going through that. And what's very interesting is that this world that we are constantly creating, you know, moment after moment, has this ability to distort the moments of contact. So they reaffirm, they confirm the world that we've created. We hear something and we listen to what we want to hear. We interpret it based on what our worldview is. And contrary things are ignored or reinterpreted. This is why sometimes things like racism, prejudice, are so difficult to overcome, because we just keep reinterpreting that. And even the simple relationship issues when we have a belief and we just can't hear the other side. I am always right and you are always wrong. So this is the essential pattern and also the essential issue that we are trying to tackle, trying to get some foothold on. And it occurs in small ways constantly throughout the day, throughout our lives. Often it's fairly benign, just an interpretation of reality. And we may realize, oh, I was mistaken about that. And of course, it occurs in much more serious, much more impactful ways. You know, the increased likelihood of police to use lethal force if that person they're encountering isn't white. This bias, this way, this world that they've created. There's also the small cumulative insults, the oppression that weighs upon ourselves and upon others. And also in our own minds, how we hold the sense of myself, the sense of who I am. This is the field of our practice. Is to make the unconscious conscious, to start to learn how to liberate our hearts and our minds. So how to start to make this process more alive for us? I've been reading this book lately called Deep Survival by a man named Lawrence Gonzalez. And it's not a Dharma book. It's really looking at how people deal with survival situations. Why do some people able to live and survive and others don't, regardless of their training or their history? So it's exploring some of the the physiological, neurological, psychological aspects, and also the fact that things happen outside of our control. And in reading this book, there's some striking examples of how this pattern of creating our world, shows up and how it contracts with reality. And so some of these points are lovely explorations of Dharma, especially around dependent origination. And the extreme example of these, the nature, extreme nature of life and death in the wilderness, makes the lessons more clear. It helps us by highlighting them to say, hopefully, how this also shows up in this more mundane life, this mundane example of my myself and of my worldview, how it applies to our own practice and to our own minds. So particularly on this topic of contact in the world that we create, that we make. So there's this one quote from this book. There's actually a quote of another psychologist, Al Sherbert, wrote in the book, The Survivor Personality, that the survivor does not impose pre-existing patterns on new information. So does not impose pre-existing patterns on new information, but rather allows new information to reshape their mental models. Okay, so as meditators, this phrase can resonate, that we're constantly trying to and practicing to learn to release our preconceptions, our pre-ideas of what this moment is, to meet it how it actually is, to actually come back to just the simplicity of our breath, the simplicity of this sensation. It's what we work on from day one, you know, to learn to say, okay, my idea of thinking, or my idea of breathing is different than the actual sensation of breathing. And what I think is often overlooked, though, that this practice that we teach right from the beginning and in the intro class is not something that it's a profound teaching. You know, we're practicing for a fundamental shift of perception of being in the world that starts to be applicable to the deepest ways we hold ourselves. If you learn how to meet a breath very directly and immediately, free of our ideas of the breath, free of our conceptions around the breath, that starts to teach us how do we do that when our emotional state is gripping us, when our minds are contracted. To see that this too is just a sense data, that we've added a lot to it. We've added so much to this. Another quote from this book, and this is from quoting Lawrence Gonzalez directly. Everyone, to one degree or another, sees not the real world, but the ever-changing state of the self in an ever-changing invitation ever-changing invention of the world. Okay, so we see not the real world, but the ever-changing state of the self in an ever-changing invention of the world. We live in a continuous reinterpretation of sensory input and memories, and they are contained in presets that can, at any given moment, light up neural networks in a shifting kaleidoscope of energy, which we then come to think of as reality. Okay, this is a beautiful statement of dependent origination, that we don't see life directly. We see it through our interpretation. It's a reinterpretation of sensory input and memories and the presets in our lives, presets in our minds make us interpret it in a different way. It points to how this moment's experience is not objective, but profoundly subjective, based on our conditioning, based on our history. Another way to say this is that we see, when we're making contact with the world through our senses, we're usually actually seeing our own minds. We're seeing a reflection of our own minds, not what is actually present, not what is actually here. And when we take a sense of identity, a sense of birth into a sense of reactivity, or even just I'm really here having this experience, that tends to funnel all the contacts, all the points of sense data into reaffirming that world. And contrary things, things that don't fit in, are simply ignored or reinterpreted. You know, if the facts don't meet your theory, throw out the facts, that old saying. And this happens constantly. It's a constant, okay, that doesn't meet what my view is of this moment, of this world. And often the feedback of our lives, of the world, doesn't really draw our attention to it, because it's, again, it's often in this kind of subtle level. But if we travel out into the wilderness, as this book explores, that feedback from the world can be much more obvious, much more easy to sense, to experience, to catch our attention. You know, it affects their ability for us to survive. And this extreme lesson teaches us something fundamental, yet very deep about Dharma practice. Something very deep and significant about practice. How our senses, we so much to learn how to come back just to this moment, just to what this breath is, just this thought, just this emotion, without adding things to that. And that distortion is the language, it's the expression of dependent origination. It's the origination of suffering, of dukkha. The third concept I want to just mention from this book is what he called the tendency to bend the map. To bend the map. So the map is a representation of, literally, of the geography of the land, of reality. And one expert said that whenever you start to look at your map and start saying things like, well, that lake could have dried up, or that boulder could have moved, a red light should go off. If you've ever been in your map, you're looking at your map and you're looking at the actual land around you, and you realize, well, I must be in there. Maybe something's wrong with the map because it doesn't match what I'm actually seeing. It's not matching the terrain. This is the bending of the map. We're trying to make reality conform to our expectations rather than seeing what's there. Bending the map. A few years ago, Carrie Peterson and I were teaching up in Bellingham, the Sangha there, and I had lived in Bellingham for about a year. And so I felt like I knew the town, I knew the territory. And in my mind, I had this sense of relationship between downtown Bellingham and Fairhaven. It's like, okay, I know where they are. I traveled those many times. And somehow in my mind, I always thought that if you're driving up I-5, Fairhaven came after Bellingham, downtown Bellingham. And in fact, it's the other way around. So I was driving up with her and said, okay, I know where we're going, and we're going to Fairhaven. So we have to go past this. And we mixed our exit and had a turnaround. This is a simple example of how my mental map really was distorted. Right? So I conformed reality to fit my image of reality. We take this same process into our own sense of self, the sense of who we take ourselves to be. And again, we distort and filter to reinforce that sense of self. This goes into a more deeper personal element of the Dharma. There's this way that Sharon Salzberg described this, I think, very nicely, which I've shared before, but I think it's helpful. And she says that I was teaching with my colleague, Joseph Goldstein, when a student came to see him in great distress. The man said he just had a terrible experience. He was meditating, felt tension in his jaw, and suddenly realized what an uptight person he is, how he can't get close to anyone, and that he's going to be alone for the rest of his life. "You mean you felt some tension in your jaw?" Joseph said. The man continued with his projections, seeing that he was pretty sure he would always be tense, never change. He felt hopeless. "You mean you felt some tension in your jaw?" Joseph said. I watched the man continue barreling down this path of misery for some time, all because of a sore jaw, until finally Joseph said, "You're having a painful experience. Why are you adding a horrible self-image to it?" And you see this from this view of contact, the point of contact of sensation, that there's pain in the jaw. Even the idea of pain is an elaboration. There's this sensation, a noxious sensation. And this man reinterpreted that sensation to match a world created by his mind. He used it to reinforce this sense of self. And Joseph kept trying to bring him back to this contact. You mean you have tension in your jaw. And created in this way the cycle of suffering. So contact is driven by all the previous links of dependent origination, that which shapes and distorts how we view this moment and sets up the distortion of the world that we view. Again, we're so often not meeting the world as it is, but we're meeting our mind's interpretation of it. We're literally meeting our mind's conditioning as much or more than the actual sense data. And so the whole purpose of our practice, one of the fundamental purposes of it, is to learn how to clear our distortion from our vision in relating to this world, to relating to reality, how it actually is. Years ago, Christina Feldman phrased this in this way, that we learn to free the world from our conditioning. Freeing the world from our projection to allow the world to be how it actually is. So to do this, we have to take responsibility for our own conditioning. We have to learn to sense it, to recognize it, especially the unconscious qualities of it. All that comes after the moment of contact, all that's added on, the programming, the conditioning, and our actions that are based on that world, to take that sense of responsibility, of ownership. So our task as Dharma practitioners is learning to free ourselves from that conditioning. So how can we practice with this contact? I offer a different approach than I did the first talk in June. And it's helpful to orient around this point of contact because it is this interface with reality. It's like, how can I ground in that? That's why it's emphasized so much in our meditative training. Okay, just this step, just this breath, just this sensation. So the first one is in the point of contact. And even if there's a state of reactivity going on, notice what is being added to it. What am I adding to this point of contact? What is my actual experience versus my interpretation? This is an essential point that we work on from day one as meditators. What is the difference between the idea of breathing, the concept of breathing, versus the actual sensation of breathing? The idea of the breath is not the breath itself. It's very different once we see that. And it's wonderful to see students see that transition, to shift from the conceptual world to the felt sense world. But we must realize that this is not a basic teaching. This is actually a hologram of the deepest teachings. If we can learn to experience all aspects of our minds, of our bodies in this way. Because we're meant to take that simple experience, okay, I'm feeling sensation. I'm seeing my thoughts of it are different than the sensation. We're meant to take that lesson to all aspects of our lives, into how we elaborate upon emotion, upon thought, how we elaborate into a sense of self. This is dependent origination. And I think it's helpful as a general rule of thumb to always assume that we're adding something to this moment. We're always adding some level of interpretation, even as simple as a label. Okay, I recognize that. Even a sense of reactivity or memory or recognition. That's all something that's added to the essence. And if that process starts to quiet, if we start to able to meet this moment in a much more simple way, we should also see a responding quiet in ourselves. We should start to feel a sense of quietude and stillness starting to arise too. Because really this labeling, this interpretation is what keeps us churned up, what springs us into this whole quality of selfing, of dependent origination. When this happens, there can often be a feeling of the ground falling away, of a sense of reference falling away. Because you stop being so engaged. You stop being so involved in what's being experienced. The experience is simply being known. There's this deep embrace of knowing that comes forth when we're not so involved in interpreting and changing reality. There's a very famous analogy from the Buddhist time of the blind men and the elephant, and how each of them came to the elephant and experienced a different aspect of that animal. And they would argue about what was an elephant. And some would say it's like describing the tusk being like a long spear, and someone else talking about the legs being this kind of like a trunk of a tree, or the sensation of the ears being this kind of soft membrane, or the tail. And so often we get caught up in our beliefs and our interpretation, realizing maybe I should just step back and come back to that point of contact. This is very hard to do, actually. When we think we know something, to step back and say, okay, what is it really? This is the beginner's mind of Suzuki Roshi, that willingness to forget what we know. And the more we know something, I know I see some couples out there, how can you meet your spouse in a fresh way instead of all the years that you've spent together? Can you meet yourself in a fresh way? Allow this, whatever is manifesting, to be just how it is. So coming back to this point of contact is this first suggestion, and seeing, what am I adding to it? What have I added to it? And learning to release that. The second suggestion for practice is, in this moment, notice what other points of contact are available or presenting themselves. We have all these six senses, if you include thought, finding a point that of an anchor, often something that's less charged, it's less reactive, something that we are less likely to engage with mentally. So like, okay, I may be caught up in a mental storm. Where's my feet? What's a contact of the feet on the ground? What's the sensation of a breath? What's the sound of the wind moving through the trees? Coming back to some other element of this moment helps to suddenly balance our attention, so we're not so focused on. The more tightly we get focused, that's much more this whole tight-knit pattern of selfing, of dependent origination, as we'll explore in the coming months, going into that craving and clinging and becoming. This is when we're really opinionated, when we're very reactive, when I am right, you're wrong. To help balance our attention, to find a place of stability, we come back to some other points of contact. This is what we call as an anchor, okay, finding that point of stability that we can anchor our attention to. So the point of contact, adding, noticing what's added on. The second one is, what other points of contact are available in this moment? And the third one is noticing, it's this more of a stepping back to noticing, what is the state of mind? What is the state of mind that's all these contacts points are arising from? These sensations, these thoughts, these sounds. You know, what's the kind of the general quality, the weather system, if you will? You know, is it kind of a fearful mind right now? Is it a sad mind? Is it a longing mind? Is it reactive? Is it happy? And it's really helpful to acknowledge the state of mind. This is stepping back into the third foundation of mindfulness. And we're letting go of the content for a moment and noticing the actual shape of the mind. By doing this, we start to see what is shaping our contact, our interpretation of this sense data. You know, finding a way to relate to a state of mind as a state, not as reality. So, okay, I'm in a bad mood, and I'm in a grumpy mood. I'm in a happy mood. Then you start to observe it and meet that, make connection with it. It can be so helpful to have a precision, like, okay, what's really this mind state? What's the stance that I've taken? Because it feels so real, so significant until we take a closer look at it and see that, okay, this is just a combination of vague beliefs, emotions, thoughts. We start to see it's not inherently substantial. And then we start to see how this colors all our thinking, all our sense data. It all gets funneled toward this reinforcing this state of mind, this state of self. So these three points we can bring into the homework of, again, coming back to the point of contact, seeing what I've added to it, coming back to that bare contact, noticing what other contact points are available. And finally, noticing the state of mind, this overarching way that I am relating, viewing the world. In doing this, we're starting to take steps towards seeing the true nature of life, the true nature of ourselves. And as we become less invested in our perception and the sense of me, this, we're more able to see the world directly, able to make adjustments, or more able to see our unconscious qualities of racism in our hearts and make course corrections, take the feedback from life, our self-image, our self-belief. We become less and less invested. Now, this is a kind of a, what do you call it, a point here in practice where we have to make a decision in some ways of what our practice is really about. Because we can become, by doing this, become much better at swapping our sense of our mental map, our sense of us, so it's more flexible, more adaptable. So it's a better aligned with the reality. So you take, you know, we take that tendency to interpret life and we learn to refine it so it's more accurate. We become less invested. But all along, we're just simply swapping different senses of me. The sense of identity becomes a little bit more pliable. But ultimately, the sense is not to lead. Ultimately, we're not trying to lead to a different sense of me, but actually pierce this veil, this power of delusion, this ignorance of self. This is why these two suttas that I spoke of earlier, that the world, I talked about how the world creates. The Buddha also finished that sutta with how the world ends. And not the world ending as with an apocalyptic issue or destruction, but just this quality of selfing, this quality of interpretation. So we're simply meeting life how it is. Another way to see this, to say this, is seeing the inherent emptiness of each experience, each thought, each sense, each sound. Now, the Venerable Ananda asked the Buddha this question about emptiness in the Sunna Sutta. So he asked the Sutta, O Blessed One, it is said that the world is empty. The world is empty, Lord. In what respect is it said that the world is empty? And the Buddha responded, in as so far as it is empty of a self or of anything pertaining to a self. Thus it is said, Ananda, that the world is empty. And empty of a self or anything pertaining to a self, the eye is empty of a self. Forms are empty of self. Eye consciousness is empty of self. Eye contact is empty of a self or anything pertaining to a self. The sense of emptiness that we, the sense of consciousness, the sense of contact is inherently empty, that it doesn't pertain to a sense of I, of me, and mine. This is the Buddha describing the ending of this, of the world. Again, not the world, not in a dismal way, not in a way of grief, but actually a way of deep peace. They're not taking birth into the sense of reactivity, the sense of longing, the sense of insufficiency. sometimes I reflect on what is this mechanism that keeps, you know, what's the impulse of keeping selfing? And you can see that releasing the selfing releases suffering in a profound way. I think a fundamental issue that we all deal with is that the world is really unstable, is inconsistent. You can see the instability with acuteness now with the world gripped by COVID and the outrage over racism. And so this world of change, but it's always there, even when things are seemingly going very smooth. It's a fundamental issue that we struggle with as humans. And so Dharma points to a way of relating to life from change. A famous Greek philosopher, Heraclitus, is famous for saying that no man or woman ever steps in the same river twice, for it is not the same river, and they are not the same person. So no person ever steps in the same river twice, for it is not the same river, and they are not the same person. Such a profound image of this. Literally, the river is, it seems like it's continuous, it's ongoing, but you step into it, it's different water, moment after moment. And that, I love how he points back to you, that this too, the sense of me is also constantly changing. The Buddha said it this way, that while I was just an unenlightened bodhisattva, being myself subject to birth, aging, ailment, death, sorrow, and defilement, I sought after what was also subject to those things. Okay, so you realize, wow, you know, I'm subject to change in a very fundamental way. I'm constantly in flux. And yet I seek my happiness in things which are also in flux. So you realize he was doing that. And he said, well, why do I do that? Now, this seems like it doesn't make any sense. So suppose that I being subject to change, seeing the danger of that, instead of seeking peace, happiness, and what also changes, I sought after the unborn, the unaging, the unailing, the deathless, the sorrowlessness, the undefiled supreme release of bondage, of nibbana. So ultimately, this is what the practice is about. And it can be as simple as meaning this moment without adding anything to it. And not adding anything to this moment, this point of contact, starts with being with it quietly, still, releasing the idea of this moment, this sound, this sensation, releasing the reactivity that may come up with it. And then much deeper, releasing the very sense of you who's experiencing it, the very sense of you which is observing. Instead of annihilation, there's actually something else that emerges, reveals itself. The deep knowing that's always been present, that's always permeating, sensing, experiencing. In this way, we're truly living life, not our interpretation of life. All right, let's sit quietly for a few moments, letting those words settle where they will. So before we open to any comments or questions or sharing you might have, I'd like to just say a few words about the homework. And I think I should be able to send it to you. Yes, I just sent it as a chat. So this title of this talk is Contact in the World That We Create. And how we are constantly creating our reality from a moment of sense contact. This manufactured world defines how we think, feel, and act. Okay, so the reflection is to notice that, to start to see, well, this is how I've interpreted the world, and I therefore logically I act from that. But seeing how that interpretation is not universal, it's not an absolute reality. It's a very much a relative reality created by your own history, by your own beliefs, your own conditioning. And practice seeing through this illusionary world by returning to the direct contact of your senses. Okay, so this is, a very simple, familiar part of meditators' experience, is coming back to the breath, coming back to the sensations. But do it in the context is understanding that by doing so, I'm releasing the world I've created. You've released the world you've created to make contact directly, clearly. Ask questions like, what is my mind adding to this contact? What's the interpretation, the label, the reactivity? Seeing how this is taking responsibility for what you add to this moment. And not with a sense of judgment or how I should be or shouldn't be, but simply noticing it. Ask what other points of contact are present, especially ones that don't trigger your reactivity. This is such an important secret to navigating life. So, okay, in this moment, I may be really reactive to this one person, to this one issue, but yet there's other aspects of this moment which are available, which are cool, they're all quiet. And finally, noticing what's the overall state of my mind, of my emotions. Again, to do that, you have to step back a little bit. You can't be so caught in it that you can't observe it. If you're caught in it, you're engaging from it, and it's automatically shifting how you view and experience the world. So stepping back a little bit, say, oh, I'm kind of cranky. I'm upset. My blood sugar is low. I didn't get enough sleep last night. These very simple qualities, and notice how they tend to make you more brittle, more friable. Or you slept well and things are going well and there's a sense of open-heartedness. This also is a way that shapes the way you interpret life. You start to find the very same data, the same input, you can have a completely different experience from it based on the state of mind. So again, this is an obvious thing that we often overlook. So asking you to take the meditation into, in some ways, off the cushion into a much more personal way of being in the world. And finally, how does that state distort my interpretation of my senses? To notice this, see it in small ways and start to bring it into deeper, bigger ways in your life. All right, so we have some chance for any comments or questions. And I'll give you the ability to unmute yourself. Yeah, I think you have that. All right, so if you'd like to share something, you could unmute yourself and speak, or you could send a chat or raise your hand, although I may not see you.
Hi, Tim. This is Sarah.
Hi, Sarah.
I don't have a question. I have a reflection that I feel like I really heard your teachings tonight. And thank you.
You're welcome. So what resonated with you tonight?
I think the idea that we don't have to change any moment, and we don't even have to change ourselves, just the allowing to be in it almost without reactivity, just seeing it for what it truly is. I can't describe it more than that. I feel that in my personal life. I feel that in my professional life. And it really resonated with me.
Yeah, beautiful. Thank you for sharing that. I think this sometimes what gets in the way of that is the need to do something with, to act, to do the right thing or not to do the wrong thing. And it takes a lot of trust to be willing to simply meet the moment how it is in a very full way, you know, to let the patterns of reactivity and just to make contact. And the trust that from there, the action will naturally take care of itself. So thank you for sharing that, Sarah. Who else may want to share something?
I liked the part, Tim, where you were saying as we came back to the breath, we were, you know, tearing down the reality of the moment or our reality. And it just struck me, this whole thing you used to say about, or you do say about the house builder and this constant just destroying and rebuilding and seeing more clearly was really nice.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that, Ron. It's that simple act of coming back to the breath. I think as we begin meditation, we often feel like that's what I'm supposed to do as a meditator. But we don't realize by coming back to the breath, what we're really releasing is this interpretation, this elaboration. It's also releasing that sense of the house builder, that sense of selfing. And for those who aren't familiar with that phrase, it's from the Dhammapada. And it's said to be the first words the Buddha said after he awakened, that the house builder, I'll paraphrase it, is, I've seen you, and that now no longer your rafters and your ridgepoles, you will build. And this is this deep momentum of creating the self, this impulse to make the self. And yet it seems like it's so esoteric and so far away. And yet it's as simple as coming back to something like the breath. Learning to meet it in a very simple way. And then even more simply, can I just let the breath breathe itself? Can I let the sensation be known and not having to be so involved, so engaged? Thank you, Ron. All right, give a few more moments to see if anything arises around your practice, the talk, dependent origination, how to work in the world with these difficult times. Looks like, Deb, you have your hand raised.
I have a question. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay.
I can hear you now. Yes.
Okay, great. My question is this, and I don't know if this is, I think it's related to contact, but I suspect that it goes a little bit further. And I was thinking about this situation this morning. I was listening to a podcast, and they were talking about the coronavirus, the situation about the coronavirus. And it was actually rather dire, rather upsetting. And so what part of that is contact? If you're listening to some information that is factual, let's assume it's factual, let's assume it's true, facts about a virus and how it affects the human body and whatnot. So we'll assume that this is facts, and I have contact in the sense of that I'm hearing this information, and I have a chain reaction to that information being presented to me.
Yes.
I have a lot of aversion. I have a lot of fear. I have a lot of anxiety. I have a lot of sense of dread. But someplace back in the very beginning of like, okay, I hear this report. Is that the contact part? And then it kind of flows on from there. Is that where the contact is?
Yes. Yeah. The contact, the initial contact point, it actually gets really complex because the contact point, like in that story, in that example, you're hearing a story about the direness of the COVID infection and how whatever predictions they might have. So when you first hear that, and you start to feel that point of fear growing, for example, or that sense of dread or apprehension, you start to notice that, okay, I've shifted from simply meeting moments experience, feeling the breath, feeling sensation, hearing sounds, and it started to move me into this state of becoming. Okay, so state of becoming may sound kind of esoteric, but you know, when you start to feel a sense of fear and anxiousness, you're in the midst of a state of becoming. You've given birth to yourself. You've given birth to a fearful manifestation of that sense of self. And what gets complex is that state of self, and then especially you're hearing the story go on and the report go on, each of those contacts kind of reinforms that. So you kind of have initial sense of self, forms this sense of a fearful self, and then everything gets reinterpreted through that. And so it kind of becomes more and more anxious, perhaps. And everything is, you stop listening to maybe the birds in your backyard, and instead you're focusing on this reality. This is the sense of tunnel vision that we have. And we get, so everything else falls away except for this one thing. And so it's complex because that point of contact, there's all these other contacts that are happening. In other words, if other sense data, other thoughts are rising, other words coming up. But it's kind of part of this bigger manifestation. So it's almost like a large wave that moves through, and there's little small waves on top of that. But there's this big current that's moving through, or like a storm that's moving through that has squalls and has, you know, different thunder and stuff like that. But it's part of this whole system that's moving through that has different manifestations. So it's like a big sense of becoming, of birth, of selfing from a point of contact, and all these kind of small points of contact within that. Does that make sense, Deb?
It does. And so to go back to what you were saying about recognizing that this is my contact, recognizing I'm interpreting this with a fair bit of this morning was anxiety and dread. But is that unrealistic in this instance? You know, it wasn't my low blood sugar. It was, you know, kind of a assessment of like, yikes, this is, you know, not sounding too good. What would the teaching suggest about how to manage that, how to look at that anxiety in that moment?
Yeah.
Because it seems so convincingly true that it's, you know, genuinely anxiety provoking.
Yes. Yes. And this is, you know, it's such a kind of a challenging part of practice. It's like, it's one thing when you just kind of hear a bird song and you kind of have a little fancy about it. But when it comes really gripping and it feels like it's really a significant thing to worry about, to really get engaged with. And there's these facts around that, and like you make this whole world at it. And that's the part that gets, it's like the, our minds are very good at figuring out the problems, right? The issues of our life and how do we solve that. And so there's an element that of that is very helpful and very beneficial. And there's a part of it that, for the lack of a better word, is a little neurotic, is a little obsessive in the mind. And the mind gets really contracted. And this also becomes compounded by, you know, I've spoken many times of our negativity bias, how we tend to highlight in our experience what is dangerous, what is wrong, what is threatening. And then we have a media that is focusing on that. You know, you get more viewers if you report on what's going badly than what's going well. And so we have this distorted view of the world from that. So even so, okay, let's say you're caught in the middle of let's take it out of COVID for a second. And let's go, or let's go into COVID in a more personal way. Let's do it this way. Let's say you've contracted the illness and you're sick, you know, and you feel your body weakening. You feel that sense of contraction, of lack of breath, and the fear of what that's going to lead to. Is it going to lead to my death? Is it going to lead to permanent impairment? You know, am I going to infect my loved ones? These are all real concerns. But how do we weigh that in our minds? Do we weigh in a way that is of fear and contraction, or of curiosity? And going back to this book I'm reading about, you know, why do some people survive and some people don't? And there's a story of this teenager who crashed in the jungle, and as she was falling down through the air, her plane disintegrated. She was like, oh, those trees look like cauliflowers. You know, so right from the beginning, she has this relationship of curiosity, of interest, of relating to life how it is instead of how I think it should be. And I think that's a probably a big point there, Deb, you know, both for the specific example and also through any time that we get worried about something that's really real, a real diagnosis, a real loss of a relationship, of function, whatever it might be. There's a reality to it, but then there's all this that's added to it. And so often there's this struggle with how we want life to be versus how it actually is. So learning to say, okay, there's a sense of curiousness, of engagement with how life actually is in this moment. And from there, there's a creativity of how do I manage that if it is manageable? Or perhaps I turn toward using the time I have with a sense of urgency, of prioritizing, of really living life as well as I can. So something like that, when you hear the dire nature of COVID, you know, is to realize, okay, that it triggers something in me. So the first thing is to take that deep responsibility that this is being triggered. This is what my anxiety is my own anxiety. It's what I'm feeling. And yes, it's based in some truth and some reality. And yet some of it is added on. And you know, to find that interesting balance, that sweet balance there. And so what I would say in the midst of that, it's really hard to shift out of the being an anxious mind. So it's helpful to bring these other tools of finding a place of balance of mind and say, okay, what else in this moment can I connect with? You know, the something that's benign or pleasant. So my mindfulness, my attention starts to quiet down, become more stable. Then I can turn toward it. You know, what's the essence that is represented by COVID for me in this moment? Is it my mortality? Is it my last lack of freedom? Is it my fear of loss, my grief? So you become more clear of that. And then instead of having this whole story, you've kind of crystalled down to the core of where it catches you. And that often is much more workable than the story that is complex and elaborate.
Thank you. I understand what you're saying. It is difficult sometimes to do it in the moment, though. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. In the moment, it can be really, you can really be swept off your feet. So learning to to recognize that, okay, I'm swept off my feet. And yes, yeah, every one of us is going to deal with our own mortality, the mortality of the ones we love. This is not a unique experience in humankind. I mean, everyone that we've ever known, everyone that who's ever lived has dealt with it in some way or in another. And so we have it as a kind of a universal focus around COVID, but it's, you know, we can learn to work with it in a very fruitful way. So a skillful way.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Iris, I see that you, and also let me go to Khaled real quick. He wrote a chat here, and I'll get back to you for a second. Let's see. Excuse my eyes while I squint at this. To clarify, the sense contact is able to break us from illusions of the mind, all illusions of the mind, would there be a time when your sense contact is an illusion, i.e. for mental illness? Okay. Yes, absolutely. I mean, the sense contact, you know, certainly it can be impaired from different reasons. You know, it can be whether our senses are irritated or distorted. You know, there's different medical conditions, and certainly a sense of mental illness, for example, can really distort how we interpret things. And so it's, I don't know quite what the point of it, but if your question is, but yes, it's absolutely true that the sense contact often can be an illusion. And generally so, there's always some level, almost always a level of distortion around it. As meditators are learning to come back to that point of contact. I don't know if that addressed it, but hopefully.
Yes, okay. I think I just wanted to understand like the nature of illusion. And it seems like even sense contacts has an inherent illusion to it. Yes. So does that mean all things are illusion? And how does that tie to non-self? That's kind of where I'm trying to get at.
So the illusion really comes into our story making around contact. Mm-hmm. How we see something and we interpret it, we make an idea of it. Now this, you know, we have to realize that there's, you know, our minds certainly can often interpret pretty accurately. There can be a very functional way of interpreting. If I go out, I know, you know, which is my car, I know where, how to go to work. Those kind of all interpretations of reality. If we just go back to that wordless wonder, we would not be very functional, right? And so it's kind of, but the trouble is when we mistake that interpretation as being absolute. So it's kind of like we learn to walk in both worlds, and we can walk in this sense of going to the absolute wonder of how this moment's unfolding, dropping all sense of label, of interpretation, all sense of me experiencing it. So it's just simply the knowing and what's being known. And then I can switch to, okay, I'm going to problem solve how to fix my flat tire. You know, I know where all those mechanisms are. Or if I have to, with your work, you know, figure out how to take care of a patient. It's so it's interesting interplay. But when we live just in the relative world, we don't have access to the absolute. But we have access to absolute, the relative has its proper place. And we can realize that when that relative doesn't match or it has much more friction or distortion around life, it can switch to something else. Does that make sense?
Yes, thank you very much. All right.
Thank you, Valerie. All right, so it looks like Lauren and Iris had something. Go ahead, Lauren, and then we'll come to Iris. Yes.
I was wondering about the sixth sense door, the sixth sense being the mind and thought, but it also would not just be thought, it would be mind states, wouldn't it? Would be an object of the sixth sense door, the mind.
So is mind states, you know, another manifestation of that sixth sense door of the mind?
Yes, that's one question, because it just seems to me that particular sense and the contact there, including the contact, is different. It's like the other sense doors and sense contacts, but it's different, just like Deb was explaining, because she was responding. Her contact with somebody else's thoughts.
Yes.
Right?
Right.
Which then probably she had a lot of thoughts, and then she had a lot of mind states as a response, and then she had the contact from those. And just like you were saying, it kind of proliferates.
Yes.
So it's hard to, it's really hard to have just bare attention to that, feel that just that contact, you know, that simple contact when you're talking about ideas and your own ideas, your own thoughts, mm-hmm. and your own mind states and somebody else's mind states. So I just wondered if there were special, because I was looking at your practice guidelines 1, 2, and 3, and are there special ways to deal with contact with the mind? And just dealing with that sixth sense door.
Yeah, the sixth sense door of the mind is often, you know, it's where we go into the elaboration. It's when we go into the distortion. So it's one of those ones we have to be very attentive of. That, you know, that's the mind gate is really where we react from, that we add elaboration and interpretation from. And so seeing it as a pure state, it's often when you're, you know, I'm sure you've experienced this like on a retreat or just walking through the park and suddenly a thought pops up and you realize that it generates all these other thoughts. So it's kind of like that's the seed point of contact. And there's all this other stuff that comes after that. All that stuff that comes after it, you know, there's elements of contact, but it's much more probably better seen as a becoming, as a sense of birthing into a state of self. And so I tend to put the sense of the state of mind as a broader quality, not this point of contact. Just like if, you know, how the different senses can also be shaped or distorted by experience or by environment. Like let's say I've been in a movie theater and I come out and it's bright sunlight, everything's really hypersensitive. You know, so the state of that conscious of them, that the state of that eyesight is shaped by that quality. I don't know if I'm making sense, but I would tend to keep.
Yeah, just so what's the state of mind at this contact? Is that one of the things that would be a good question to ask?
Yes.
When you're confronting and responding to that object, that.
Yes, okay. Exactly. Yeah. Okay. What's the state of mind that's here?
Right. Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
All right, Iris, sorry to make you wait. I got some notes in terms of who asked first with this chats and stuff, but go ahead.
Also in response to Deb's comments that we're often, I think, fearing the future. So yes. when our fear gets kicked up, we're worried about something that we think may happen, whether it's around COVID or climate or the man who had a pain in his jaw, and then he was going to be alone for the rest of his life. And so, you know, sort of coming back to the present moment when you know, I'm caught in fear is really very helpful because I'm worried about something that has not happened, may never happen. And my worry at that point is causing me suffering and not very helpful, even though it's certainly understandable.
Yes.
But I've gotten wrong.
Yeah, I think that's a better way to describe it is coming back to what's here right now and how the fear is often into the future, right? Just as you said that really nicely. It's like that sense of, okay, what's right in front of me? That's the point of contact. That's the place of connection. And the mind goes in, yeah, it goes into the future tripping. It goes into the past tripping and to find, okay, where is this present moment? It's hard, like when you have to make plans of how do I take care of this? How do I strategize? And yet even, you know, if I make a plan to climb a mountain, each step I can be completely present for. So you can create your plan and then you release the outcome. All right, thank you for sharing that. So we have, thank you all for your engagement. And we have a few announcements and Khalid, I think, is doing those tonight.
Sure. Hi, everyone. I'm Khalid. I'm on the board, just here to do the announcements tonight. So for SIMS events, we have a Buddhist Essentials class starting this Wednesday, every month on Wednesday evenings, and it's on the three characteristics. Tim is doing an intro class starting on Thursdays on July 9th from 7 to 9 p.m. And then later that week, on Saturday, July 11th, our Climate Action Group is hosting a four-hour event from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., and it's entitled Reflecting on the Climate Crisis, Despair, Guilt, Love, and Connection, Opening to the Full Catastrophe. And there'll be presentations as well as small and large group discussions, and you can register online for that. Then at the end of July, on Friday, July 31st, Craig and Devin Hussey will be doing a talk on surviving modern life. And that's a Friday night talk as well as a Saturday day long. Then from the Sims board, there's a few activities we'd like to mention. So first, we're working on a page for anti-racism resources, which is being put together now and should hopefully be on the website very soon. And in addition, the board, there's a task force going on just around the planning for the eventual resumption of Sims for in-person meetings. So we're looking at the guidance from King County, and we'll be following that. And we're planning on being actually more kind of cautious than that and actually having contingency plans. So we don't have any definitive recommendations right now, but as conditions change, we'll have updates. But overall, we're very grateful just for the ability to have Zoom, for the teachers, LDLs, for being able to teach and provide guidance during this time. And so just a reminder again for Donna to help support Sims going forward and making sure the activities continue. Thank you.